Hello there, and a warm, if not somewhat stiflingly hot, welcome to this particular edition of DF Direct Weekly, which I count as the 270th. Yes, we're still in the middle of a heat wave here in the UK, so our podcasting capabilities are certainly going to be put to the test here. Joining me, sharing the ordeal, first of all, Tom Morgan, hello.
Hello. Yep, it's a scorcher. Got the fan on the go, and I'm just going to bear with it. We'll get there.
Also joining me, perhaps not as badly affected, Oliver McKenzie.
Yes, Rich, I'm in considerably chillier environs here over in Vancouver, given that it's currently midnight when I'm joining you here.
Fantastic. Okay. Good for you. Anyway, okay, so lots to get through in this particular show. But first of all, I want to get a shout out for digitalfoundry.net. Will Judd taking point there. The site's just getting better and better, going from strength to strength. This week we had our biggest traffic ever. A few stories that Will wanted to highlight there. First of all, Tom actually wrote an article for us talking about the GTA 6 asset dump, which we're going to be discussing here very, very shortly. We actually had an interview with Valve, which we split up into a whole bunch of different stories for the site there. We were hoping to do a video, but the audio quality wasn't quite up to it. Still, you can read all of the stuff there that we learned from Valve. You know, it's the stuff like, why there's only a single sodium memory module in there. Lots of stuff. I think the one Will highlighted was why Valve didn't feel comfortable about doing a bare bones version of the Steam Machine, which kind of sounds, logical to do, bearing in mind that memory and storage are so difficult for them to source, may have been easier for the user. Unfortunately, there's good reasons for that. Read about that on the site. And everybody, seemingly, is doing their own Steam Machine builds at the moment, offering a lot more performance for similar price points. We'll actually put together four different builds there, one of which is actually a small form factor machine, which a lot of people seem to have kind of forgotten in the frenzy. And he also talked about the Tri-Mode 1X Player 3 handheld, which is using the Arc G3 Extreme processor. Pretty great stuff there. And quote-unquote only $350 more than Steam Machine. Anyway, digitalfoundry.net, a lot going on there, so please do check that out. Okay, so first news story of the week, and yes, there has been a huge dump of Grand Theft Auto 6 news. We're going to be discussing that at length. Interestingly, no trailer was released alongside that, but we did get a big bunch of screenshots. Actually, Tom, I'm going to go to you first on that, bearing in mind that you did a huge amount of work on that already for the site. What do you make of this asset dump?
Yeah, no video this time. And I think it's interesting that they just left us with 63 very high quality 4K assets. And, the exact source of these assets, the console that they've been rendered on, is, a source of, a bit of a mystery at this point. They didn't put that up front, as they did with, they did with prior trailers. They might have mentioned a console that was running on. Yeah, none of that, no mention this time. So we've got like very pristine, high quality assets. And I went into this article thinking, well, this is a great showcase, firstly, of clearly they're putting ray traced reflections front and center everywhere, like really beautiful examples of how that works. And if you want to read about that, that's on the article. But I trailed this piece with, I suppose, speculation about what platform it's been rendered on, what machine is generating these images. And I suppose there's a number of ways you could look at it. It could be, these are very staged shots, obviously. You've got the characters in all sorts of very dynamic poses, like leaning against cars and just looking their best in all the outfits you can wear in the game. And showing off a bunch of scenery in the background, but it's also true that image quality, it could be, image quality is high enough and it's pin sharp enough oftentimes that you could imagine it's the photo mode or it's, maybe the game's development environment, as we called it in the article, to kind of get the best case scenario shot to really sell the game. It's yeah, it's very hard to say. But the key thing is, I personally don't think it's running in real time. This is not what we can expect from real time gameplay on a base PS5, PS5 Pro even, or Series X. So, but yeah, it's kind of up for speculation about how close we're going to get to these, the quality, the standard of visuals in these shots, because we've got ray tracing under cars, reflections look pin sharp, and you know, image quality, although there are some artifacts that I think all of you might pick up on in a second, there's it's not, you know, it is, most of them are very perfect, crisp images. So I wonder what you two think of this, what how these being generated.
Yeah, I'll come to you on that one, Oliver. But first of all, I just want to stress that I think it was the trailers, the videos that were running on base PlayStation 5. I don't think it's any screenshots. I don't think there have been disclosures on that. I'm not sure. Anyway, Oliver.
Yeah, I think that the second trailer in particular was fingered as running on PS5. I'm not sure if there was a similar disclosure for the first trailer. And we have no idea what these shots I'm running on in particular. We have no idea. But I think there are some clues, and I might diverge slightly with Tom on this one, just because, I mean, there are definite visual issues in these shots. I don't mean to say that as some knock on the game. I think it's a good thing to see obvious visual flaws in a showing like this. Like, for instance, the hair. When we do look at the hair, it has this kind of dithered quality, and the quality of the hair seems to sharply decrease. As you enter screen area, the it's occupying decreases. So like when you look at the hair, for instance, on Jason, it has a dithered quality, especially his facial hair. It does not look so good, but it does look sharp, whereas in prior showings it had more of a blurred appearance, so perhaps that's changed a bit. Obviously, it has RT reflections, and some of the RT reflections do look very sharp and very crisp, as you'd expect them to be on perfectly mirror-like surfaces, right? So on, like, for instance, transparent car glass, things like that, it looks very, very good. But in other areas, like on choppier waters, we can see evidence of RT reflections again, but of a considerably noisier, more aliased and uglier variety. Not to knock it, obviously those are expected compromises, but it does not look to me like something super pristine. There are also shadow maps clearly in evidence in this presentation. We're seeing obvious shadow aliasing in a few shots, close-up shots, which belies the fact that they're not using some hyper-crisp offline solution necessarily. And, you know, there are some other issues here, like maybe depth of field doesn't look that great. There's not really a clean fall off between objects that are in focus, partially in focus, and out of focus, which suggests they might not have such a perfect solution there. And maybe the bokeh shapes look a little bit too circular. Maybe that's too narrow of a critique, but that's something that I tended to notice as well. I do think that in some sense, these are bull shots in the sense that they're images that are made exclusively for promotional material, I imagine. And there are some things you can notice here, like how they're not really depicting gameplay lighting conditions. When you look at the observed light sources in a scene, like the sun or like a street lamp or something, the lighting of the characters in many cases is totally different from that. It's a very artificial kind of look there that's made for promotional material.
For sure.
It would not, I'm not even sure this kind of lighting would hold up in the context of a cutscene necessarily. And I think these images are made, poses, lighting, arrangements, everything is made exclusively for this promotion, not assets perhaps, but certainly the arrangement of those assets in the scene is made for promotional purposes, which makes sense. But I think this is probably conceivably something that could run on a console in a 33 millisecond frame time, but it's kind of hard to say, honestly, because when you do look at imagery like this, I mean, when we think about the modern world of temporal upscalers in relatively still imagery, it doesn't really tell you a whole lot to look at an image like this and say, oh, this is super crisp and clean and looks good. Like, because it could be running at 720p internally, right? And it could just be upscaled effectively and shown in these kinds of screenshots. There are different kinds of techniques that could be in play here, but ultimately, I think this is probably fairly plausible. The one area of divergence with prior showings is that previously we saw the game running at about 1440p, minus black bars, so maybe it would technically be like 1152p, but like 2560 by 1152, something in that range vicinity, if I'm remembering correctly. Running with what would appear to be FSR1 as the upscaler of choice. It looked fairly similar to FSR1. So this would be a bit of a break from that, but again, I'm probably reading a little bit too much into this one. We know so little about the provenance of these images. I'd be very curious to see where they come from. But it would not shock me to learn that this was actually captured from real-time footage at, you know, 33 millisecond frame time on a console, that wouldn't be too shocking to me. And overall, like, the level of visual quality in these screenshots, I mean, it's extraordinary. I think it's even more polished looking than the prior photo dump that we had last year, which showed a variety of characters in the game. This looks extremely polished, extremely smooth, and I think they're getting their rendering into tip-top shape here with some of the changes to hair rendering, which I think make the game look more pleasing. And ultimately, this is just super, super appealing. Now, I would have loved more media from this game, including a new trailer. I hope that's forthcoming in July. But this is a pretty tantalizing showing, and I do think it tells us something about the graphical makeup of the game as well.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot going on there, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of trickle out video through the website these days. They integrate like these video clips into the GTA 6 site as you scroll down. And I think that's as good as we got from the last blowout, which was to announce the pre-order date with that look over the city with the infamous missing Ferris wheel reflection. This time, I think we just got a shot of the two leads, Jason and Lucia, like near a car. And it's good because you can scroll up and down and see the way the RT works in that shot, but it's very low quality, you know, for our purposes. But yeah, as you say, Oliver, there's a lot of to be clear, I do think this is running on it is obviously in engine, but I don't think this is gameplay material in terms of the quality of the image quality. I think photo mode is the most likely way these have been generated, and I think, as you say, a lot of this is staged, like the way the two characters are propped up on one shot next to like an old Beatles-style car. You can kind of see that the lighting has been set up just perfectly. I can't imagine it's a very realistic cutscene moment. It wouldn't really work as a cutscene moment. It's purely there for promo material.
Okay, so I'm going to move on the GTA 6 discussion now to stuff that wasn't actually discussed or released within the disclosures this week, because there's been a lot of rumors going on. And I thought it'd be fun to actually discuss the plausibility of some of those rumors. There was a MediaMarkt leak suggesting that the game would have quality and performance modes. I don't think that one is particularly plausible. For various reasons, which we've discussed in the past. I mean, maybe there will be. We just don't know at this point. We're just sort of still of the belief that when you're dealing with a simulation of this quality, the CPU time involved is going to be beyond the current generation consoles. Even the PlayStation 5 Pro, you could sort of ramp up graphics there. That seemed like a bit sort of implausible. I mean, everything's still to play for, right? Because even in Sony's Plays Best on PlayStation blog post, there was no discussion of PlayStation 5 Pro features or indeed a 60 FPS performance mode, which you'd think they would want to get into there, but alas not. There was also an interesting leak concerning PlayStation 5 Pro features. Now, this one's kind of bizarre. We're kind of reaching a bit, I think, here, maybe in some respects, but a major Brazilian retailer, Kaboom, said that there's going to be PlayStation 5 Pro enhancements. I think we can agree with that. I think the list here is oddly specific to the point where maybe there is something to it. So let's talk about the enhancements that were discussed here. Advanced ray tracing with improved global illumination. Mm-hmm. Well, we know that there is RTGI on the trailer, and that was running on a base PlayStation 5, so makes sense. Realistic reflections on cars, waters, and the environment. Well, I think we've already discussed that that's happening anyway. Could it be enhanced on Pro? Possibly. Dynamic weather that affects physics and gameplay. We're just talking about basic gameplay features at this point, but this one is interesting. More stable frame rates, FPS, on PlayStation 5 Pro. This kind of makes sense because it's not promising 60 FPS. It's just promising smoother performance on the Pro, which, if it is a 30 FPS game, tighter adherence to the 30 FPS cap makes a lot of sense. Higher resolution on PS5 Pro kind of makes sense. Native optimization designed to take advantage of PS5 Pro hardware kind of points to PSSR2. Oliver, the source of this information is very, very obscure to the point where probably we should rule it out. But that said, what's being discussed here is plausible, right?
It is plausible. It is plausible, if only that it seems quite realistic, I would say. Like, when we're talking about better ray tracing, more stable frame rates, higher resolutions. Like, these all sound like kind of very realistic prospects, and also not that exciting prospects. Like, I think you'd hope for PSSR 2 on this title, really, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
For a title that's releasing on PS5 Pro with this graphical fidelity. That would be kind of unfortunate if it did not ship with PSSR 2, although perhaps they've cooked up some custom upscaler, or maybe they're using some variant of FSR or something that's actually got the game in reasonable shape, who knows. But this all seems like very typical boilerplate language for many PS5 Pro games that I see that don't ultimately look that much better on PS5 Pro. I will say that, because usually you're looking for one of those kind of headline features like PSSR 2. I mean, obviously improved ray tracing, improved GI, that could make a difference. But when you look at the game on PS5 base, the PS5 base model in that second trailer, it's already got pretty high quality RTGI, high quality RT reflections. It's not obviously missing some step when it comes to those features. Obviously, you know, we know from the GTA 5 enhanced edition on PC, perhaps those features are improved. You know, they certainly have many quality settings they could select there potentially. So it's entirely possible those features would be meaningfully improved on PS5 Pro, but I'm also thinking maybe it could be not that significant in the context of the game's overall appearance and look. So I'd hope that would make a difference, but I'm not quite sure what to make of these leaks, because there was a leak prior to the pre-order period for this title that said that it would be a 60 FPS title, specifically earmarked 60 FPS. So I think in some cases, these retailers can just kind of come up with copy that might seem plausible. It might get posted to their website. It might be some kind of like example text, some kind of like lorem ipsum they've drafted for this purpose. But ultimately, it doesn't actually materialize in the final game. So I would be appropriately skeptical of this. But if it were to be true, and also the other area of skepticism that I have is I believe the game is up for pre-order right this second. So why wouldn't they post this information before pre-ordering? Indeed, this game does not really have all that much information published about its performance in the various consoles in the first place. And I would really hope to see some more information on that in due course, certainly well before the game arrives. But yeah, who knows if this leak is correct? Looks plausible. Maybe it is plausible. Maybe it is true. But we'll really have to see on this one. And I would hope for PSSR support. That would be top of mind for this title.
Yeah, maybe that is the native optimization designed to take advantage of PS5 Pro hardware. I guess thing is that in the era of AI-generated summaries pretty much everywhere, I guess an AI could come up with this quite conceivably as well. Tom, is there anything that you'd like? Well, I mean, what would you like to see from a PS5 Pro version within the realms of possibility?
Well, within the realms of possibility is the catch there. I think baseline PSSR 2 support, and I think maybe 120Hz support with a 40 FPS variant. That might be nice. If they're supposing we don't have 60 FPS on the base console, that would be a nice lift for the Pro version. And I don't know, settings boosts would obviously become welcome, but it's hard to get a read on what the settings layout would be for the game. Improved GI would obviously be a winner. So I suppose it's the quality of those rays, the quality of the RT that we're getting from the base PS5 and how that look on the Pro. It's hard to say. It does scale, the game does scale well. Like Rage Engine titles previously have scaled with improved LODs. And that's probably one of the ones I'd like to see, you know. Yeah, PSSR, improved image quality.
One thing that I would say, actually, as one thing that could be interesting, is if you look at GTA 5 Enhanced Edition on the consoles, when you look at the quality of the ray traced reflections in that title in the quality mode, it uses a cube map fallback for any objects that are more than maybe like 20 feet out from the player. Mm-hmm. And indeed, in that like little video clip they published, I did notice maybe there was a little bit of a discordance between the objects that were clearly being reflected that were further away from the perspective of the camera and the ones that were closer a little bit, and the ground and background seemed to mismatch. So I do wonder, hey, maybe there's actually a considerable optimization on the PS5 or something that would have them falling back to that cube map solution at a closer distance. Whereas, you know, certainly in high-end PC right now, in the GTA 5 Enhanced Edition, you can push out the distance at which they're relying on cube maps to such a point that it really isn't apparent in typical play, whereas it is quite apparent in the consoles. So there are all kinds of things like that that they could do. They could push out that ray tracing distance. But this is all speculation on speculation on speculation.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, hopefully they would actually push out that distance considerably, even on the base console.
You know, the website is usually a good way to gauge where the upgrades are on PS5 Pro enhancements, better than usually the PlayStation Store on the console itself. You can go to the website, and usually they've got a box out further down the page on any game title saying, here are the Pro enhancements, here's exactly what it does. Nothing on GTA 6. So I can only fathom that maybe it's still being ironed out. Maybe they want to get the exact bullet points right before they go official with it. But we'll have to see.
Let's move on and talk about the more basic stuff, which is the pricing, which in itself is quite contentious. There's going to be two editions, the Standard Edition and the Ultimate Edition. And prices there, $79.99 US for the Standard, $99.99 for the Ultimate Edition. That becomes $69.99 UK pounds. Ultimate Edition, $89.99. I think the contentious thing here is basically that the Ultimate Edition is containing stuff like premium vehicles, weapons, and apparel. There have been questions about the extent to which content is quote-unquote being hoarded for the Ultimate Edition. What do you make of that, Oliver? Do you think that people are going to pay the extra there, the fear of missing out?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit tricky because it doesn't seem like it adds that much content to the game. It's kind of just some exclusive stores, some new threads, maybe a car or two, and then like a new mission. That's not nothing. It's certainly not nothing, but is it worth $20 more? Is it worth increasing the price of the product by a quarter? I don't know. And it also does not feel like the typical kind of content that we see reserved for DLC. Mm-hmm. This kind of does feel like content that was on the cutting room floor that could be in the single player version, could be in the base version of the game just fine. Obviously, you'd think, hey, maybe they should just tie it into multiplayer. But we know there's no multiplayer, at least not at launch, at least not bundled with the default edition. Their current line is that there's no multiplayer component for GTA 6. I think in time we'll find that the GTA 6 multiplayer component is spun out as its own product. That's my own suspicion. We do know that that's in development currently, but I think it's A, not going to make launch, and B, will be launched as a separate product, possibly a free-to-play product or a buy-to-play product with a separate purchase price, but not part of the base GTA 6 game, which I actually think makes sense, because when you look at GTA 5, GTA 5 Online, and GTA 5 Regular, those are two gigantic games. Maybe bundle them as separate products. That makes things a little bit cleaner, a little bit easier. Who knows? But yeah, it's kind of a bummer, kind of a weird thing here. I do think that base price of $80 is totally reasonable, though, for an entertainment product that's the biggest, most expensive, most exciting, most popular entertainment product of all time. I think $80 is perfectly fine. Nintendo has established that as a common price for high-end Nintendo titles. Obviously, we've seen that from, I think, the Switch 2 editions of Tears of the Kingdom and I think one or two other games. I think Kirby and the Forgotten Land is also $80. And then, of course, Mario Kart World. So I think it makes perfect sense for Take-Two to follow in their footsteps. But yeah, overall, I think the pricing stuff is reasonable. I'm a little surprised, though, they didn't go for like a collector's edition. That would have been really cool. Maybe a few $100, do something cool with it, some physical goods. And then, of course, this is another thing. I don't know if we want to get into it, but of course, the whole physical disc issue.
Oh, absolutely. Right, we want to get into it.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, the big news, and we actually ran it on the website ahead of the price, was the fact that there isn't going to be a proper disc in the box. You're going to go into the shop, you're going to buy your copy of Grand Theft Auto 6, and inside will be a redeem code for the PlayStation Store or the Xbox Store, which is kind of crazy. In fact, we got some comments from supporters on that. Code Malfunction asks, "Hi, DF people. As much as I hate the code in the box decision for GTA 6, do you think there could be a technical reason for this approach? Games like Indiana Jones and The Great Circle exceeded the maximum size of a UHD Blu-ray disc and required a separate download. If this is indeed the case, why are publishers hesitant to do the old-fashioned two-disc approach on PS5? Is it cost? Surely GTA 6 would have been able to easily eat the increased cost with a higher price point. Very professional Dodo actually responded to that question. I don't think there's any other way of looking at this. They simply wanted to prevent anyone from sharing or reselling the game. They could have controlled both leaks and disc space by placing just an installer that could be triggered on the day, but they didn't want to. They just wanted to prevent you from owning a transferable license. Tom, what do you make of that? I mean, I think it's not great. I mean, ideally, the best case scenario would be that you would buy a game with however many discs it needs. You'd be able to play it offline, and you know, you would own something that you could resell. All of those avenues have been basically terminated with this approach. There have been rumors, unconfirmed reports, although there are some apparent messages from Rockstar support saying a proper physical edition will come later on down the road. But it's quite difficult to disagree with very professional Dodo's point there.
Yeah. I think that it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it, to release a proper physical edition later on, to mitigate the lunacy that goes on around a GTA release. Like it's wild how you know, people jump on any leak, and you know, stores do, smaller retailers do tend to. We've seen it in the past on previous GTA titles, previous Call of Duty titles in the. Like its peak, I remember them going like days or even a week early. So I can understand that as a mitigation method from Rockstar to limit that, and then later on they can roll out the actual disc and everyone's happy again. And personally, like for a single player only game, that it makes the most sense. I just don't understand how this is a you know, that would be workable long term in terms of the money aspect, whether it's saving them money. I actually think it might be, I mean, how much does a physical disc cost versus the load on their servers on, say, day one, which is obviously going to be ridiculous. So imagine if they'd offloaded some of that strain by putting them on physical discs, baked it ahead of time for, say, half the audience. It's on the disc that were downloaded on the server, and then, you know, the rest go with the online digital version. That would have spread the load in a way. But
I do think the downloads will be considerably cheaper than making and shipping discs. I think that's there's probably quite a wide gulf there, to be honest.
And preloads.
Yeah. Preloads, yeah.
Right. Well, either way, as a result of that, we're going to have perhaps the most congested servers we've seen on Sony's networks and Microsoft's networks on day one. Although this does help in the fact you can preload, right? It's a code to help you preload in advance. So there is an advantage there.
Well, if you're, it's not so much of an advantage if you're buying the game on day one in a shop.
Yeah.
It's not great, Oliver.
Yeah, well, actually, I think Rockstar has tried to facilitate this a little bit by actually letting you buy the Code in a Box physical edition, I think on November 12th. So they're actually releasing that version for sale early, and then you can actually play it on the 19th. So they are kind of doing a little bit, you know, not just doing a big retail blowout on the 19th. They're actually kind of taking advantage of this interesting proposition with the Code in a Box to actually let people buy it early, which I think is quite, quite interesting. But I also think another big factor in this, in addition to the factors that Tom discussed, is just the fact this game is coming in a bit hot. I know there's some reporting out there that the title is in quite active development and that people are being asked to push themselves quite hard to reach the November 18th release date. And that could mean that hitting cert on a timeline that's appropriate for disc production might not be possible, right? Not be possible. And then also, you know, you really have to think, like, the version of GTA 6 that ships with code that's certified in October or September or something is probably not a version of GTA 6 that you'd actually want to play. You'd probably want to play it with some level of patching. I think ultimately the right approach for Rockstar here is to end up shipping a disc version when the game is reasonably patched, maybe when they've added some single player content to it, maybe it's part of some kind of like deluxe edition or collector's edition or game of the year edition. I know that they might be making one of those based on the game's pedigree. I think they could probably do any or all of those things and really satisfy people like John who want a complete good version of the game on disc, not just a version of the game on disc that could pass cert. Right, not just a version of the game that is incomplete in some major way because it doesn't have critical performance patches or critical content patches, things like this. So I think there's probably a way for Rockstar to navigate this that ultimately does satisfy the needs of collectors and people who are mindful of digital expirations of things like this, but it will have to come down the road, I expect, based on how they want to launch this game and how aggressive they are being with its launch date.
Yeah, but code in the box is so poor, though. It's really bad. There's yeah. no real difference between going to a shop and buying it and and just buying it from the store, unless there is some kind of like price war. I mean, in the UK, traditionally, there's been the supermarkets in particular have had price wars with hot new games and basically taking the hit themselves in order to get you into the store. That's potentially a situation that could happen. But even so, very professional Dodo's point about the fact they could have put an installer on the disc, which would have made it a transferable license. This definitely would have been a preferable approach. Mm. And it's unfortunate that they didn't do that.
And do you remember, Rich, the release of Grand Theft Auto 5, how we handled that? It was...
We didn't we buy digitally and then basically pretended to be in New Zealand or Hong Kong?
Well, we did do digital because there was a story in that, I think you remember. But I went out and bought the physical discs on 360 and PS3 at an Asda at midnight. And the buzz was, you know, the buzz in the room was, you could just feel it. Everyone was so excited. Can you imagine it? This time, people lining up on, what was it, the 12th for a preload, like, code in a box, getting home and just being like, oh, another week to wait, I guess. It's not quite the same, is it?
The other thing about this that I think is weird is they're doing it in exactly the same manner as you saw for GTA 5, which is they're not doing a global release. So people in New Zealand, Australia will be getting this game first, which doesn't portend too well for the state of leaks on platforms like Twitter, you know, that a whole region is going to be a day ahead of everyone else. That's not the way to do it, I think. I think you want to do a global launch simultaneously, regardless of the time zone that people are in, right? Probably centered on North American time, but do it globally and actually release the game all at once so that people are not getting ahead and posting all their great story spoilers all over Twitter. And I think it's a great environment for people to be in.
Okay, good stuff. Let's move on from GTA 6. Interesting situation here. Pre-orders for Grand Theft Auto 6 go live, and it's a console exclusive. And then literally, kind of like within 24 hours, Microsoft decides to raise the prices of its consoles. And it's not an insignificant increase in the cost of the hardware here. Basically, the cheapest 512 GB Xbox Series S model is now going to cost $499. With the 1 TB model going up to $600. So just bear in mind, $500 was the cost of a Series X in 2020. The Xbox Series X, the 1 TB model without a disk drive, $749.99. The version with a disk drive will retail for $800, $799.99. The 2 TB model, that has been withdrawn from sale. So, yeah, that's not great. And we also have a situation now where Apple, for a while, has been basically trying to protect consumers with various strategies for increasing pricing on its products. But Apple has now given in to the inevitable. And, we've got some pretty meaty price increases going on there. The MacBook Neo, famously cheap, $699, up from $599. MacBook Air, $1,300, up from $1,100. MacBook Pro, $2,000 now, up from $1,700. It's not great. Oliver, I think the thing that's kind of scary from my perspective is that basically Microsoft in particular are saying, hey, this is bad, but chances are it could get even worse.
Yeah, and Asha Sharma was indicating that they might expect another 2.5 times rise in the price of affected components going into 2027, late 2027, which is presumably around the time they might be thinking about launching the Xbox Helix console. So that's a huge concern. The fact that we've already seen such massive price rises, and they're likely to continue, according to industry analysts and according to people like Ashish Sharma, well into the future. That is a serious, serious concern. It's something we're going to have to contend with. But yeah, in terms of these Xbox price rises, I mean, it's just massive. In addition to price rises that you discussed, all the way up to $800 for a Series X 1 terabyte with a disk drive. That's up from $500 at launch, quite a colossal price increase. They're also discontinuing the Series X 2 terabyte, which I feel like, you know, that just kind of sucks. They're like, well, we can't even move enough units to justify this console at the current price that we'd have to ship it at. That's not a very promising sign there, with the increased in storage prices. And yeah, this is a huge negative externality from this rise in data centers. That's hugely concerning. On the Apple side of things, the price increases for some models aren't as steep, but it's really when you go deep in the upgrade tables for these computers and you actually start to spec them out with appropriate amounts of storage and memory for someone who might have more high-end use cases. Like myself, I ordered an M3 Ultra Mac Studio a couple months ago for my own personal use, for my own work use. And it was, I think, about 7,000 CAD when I ordered it. And now, right, speccing out the same system, it's almost 10,000 CAD. Right? So they've really, really bumped up the pricing if you do go relatively deep in memory, in storage in these computers. They've increased the prices in some cases by, you know, 20%, 30%, which is colossal when you're looking at the price of one of these units. So I think it's really an unfortunate situation. I'm bracing for even worse news in the future as Apple tries to roll out high-end computers later this year. Apparently, they're also skipping the M6 generation of chips for the most part. They're only releasing a low-end M6 variant, not the higher-end variants. I don't know if that's affected by some of this movement in the semiconductor market. But overall, it's just a very negative story for consumer electronics. I also saw that the new Claw device, the new MSI Claw device with the G3 Extreme processor, is, I think, retailing for $1,700 American dollars, which is another sign that, hey, this market, not very healthy at the moment. And if you have working computer hardware, if you have working gaming hardware, hold on to it. You know, it's a really bad environment for upgrades. Hopefully you already have a PS5. Hopefully you already have a Series X. Hopefully you already have a good PC. Hopefully you already have a Switch 2. And if you don't and you're interested in one, I'd advise buying one soon, because I actually think that we're going to see price movement on consoles like the PS5 in the near future, in the next couple months, given this news.
Right. Yeah. There's going to be a lot of potential used purchases as well, I suspect, as well. I think one of the things Microsoft was talking about is that they are going to renew focus on making sure that they can get refurbished consoles out, which presumably will be significantly cheaper. I mean, you can buy used, obviously. You've got no warranty at that point. That is a bit of a problem there. But with that said, you can buy, like, you know, I'm just looking at Facebook Marketplace now around my way. You can buy a Series X for under £300. Same with PlayStation 5. So, you know, there are routes forward, but obviously they're a bit riskier when you're buying used. What do you make about all of this, Tom? It's kind of curious, right? Because people are really going to want to play Grand Theft Auto 6. We've got like this once in a generation opportunity to actually expand the audience for these consoles. But at the same time, you know, are people really going to pay $700 to buy a Series X to play Grand Theft Auto?
Yeah.
Or indeed, you know, $500 for a Series S.
I know so many people in that position, in fact, who are so excited about Grand Theft Auto 6 that I know personally, who are not gamers, like who do it as an enthusiast, a hobby. And I've told them, well, are you going to get a PS5 soon? Because this is happening. Yeah, it's kind of... it's shocking, and I agree with Oliver, it's going to get worse as we go. I thought to some extent we would have been safeguarded from sharp price increases, with such great frequency, because Sony and Microsoft would have negotiated deals with the parts manufacturers ahead of time and got a contract in for a set price, perhaps. And I think that has borne out in terms of the pricing up till this point, certainly compared to what's going on in the PC market, right? You can get a PS5 Pro for much less than what you're getting for a Steam machine. But I think reality is catching up on the industry and the console side of the market, and we've just got to bite the bullet. And you're right, Rich, that the used market is probably getting a good deal on Marketplace or eBay or your local store is probably the way forward. Also, refurbishing is a great idea. Honestly, you know, making the most of the parts that are out there seems like the most economical route forward. It reminds me, though, how much did you get your Series S for when you were browsing Marketplace?
Well, yeah, maybe it's an outlier, but I did get a Series S for £65 off Facebook Marketplace. And I'm still very, very proud of that.
Yep.
It was a 20-mile drive to get there. And all of the time when I was thinking about this, as I drove there, I was thinking, I'm going to get there and it's going to be an Xbox One S. But it wasn't. It was a Series S.
Lo and behold. And
I'm quite pleased about it. It's kind of like probably my greatest Facebook Marketplace buy at that point. Yeah. We got a question here from, or even a comment from Anxiously Crollowed figured, man, Microsoft raising prices again. Valve asking a gazillion dollars for their machine. Seems like Sony and Nintendo don't really need to do that much to completely own this generation. That kind of brings me on to a point you made there about procurement of parts there, Tom. I think, you know, from what I understand, Sony have had like long-term contracts in place that have enabled them to handle this situation a bit more gracefully. Obviously, these contracts come to an end and then they need to be renegotiated and then prices go up. Mm-hmm. But I think the approach that, as I understand it, from Microsoft has been a more of a sort of just-in-time style approach to procurement, which means that... You know, they basically get the parts as they need them, and they're kind of like far more beholden to changes from price point from that regard. And it does seem to be, I don't know, that's an interesting question, Oliver. Nintendo's price rise for the Switch 2 was comparatively, quote unquote, okay compared to what's happening elsewhere. But how long can it last?
Yeah, and they also delayed their price rise. I think they
gave you time.
They're giving you time. I think they're increasing the price in September, if I'm not mistaken, for most markets. In Japan, for that really cut price domestic edition console, you know, the Sapporo of the Japanese Switch 2 market, that price increase was factored in much earlier. But it's a $50 increase, and they're postponing it until September. I don't know how long that will last, though, given these component shortages. And given the fact that Switch 2 has considerable memory and storage outlays, perhaps less than a Series X, perhaps less than a PlayStation 5, but still, you know, 256 gigabytes of storage, that's a not insubstantial number, and 12 gigabytes of LPDDR5, that is a serious concern there. So I do expect increases from the likes of Sony, from the likes of Nintendo in the future. I do just expect that it's Microsoft's shallower inventory or just-in-time manufacturing model and centralization of their manufacturing in China. Sony and Nintendo have manufacturing facilities all around the world, which allowed them to evade some of the tariff threat, right? Microsoft was directly exposed to the tariffs, whereas Nintendo and Sony were able to shuttle, you know, units from South Korea or units from Vietnam into the US market, right? I think they probably have a similar amount of flexibility with their manufacturing and their sourcing such that they can avoid some of these issues for a while. But for sure, I mean, if you think that an $800 Xbox doesn't portend at least $750, $800 PS5, I think you have another thing coming. I think that it's coming for sure in the near future, as it has with previous console price rises. You know, it took a little while for Sony to get there on price, but they were marching in lockstep with Microsoft, if just, you know, some weeks or months thereafter. They're certainly there with Microsoft on the price rises because they're exposed to the same upstream inputs that Microsoft is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's something that's puzzling me about all of this, though. We've had Prime Day this week, and there have been good deals for GPUs in the UK, at least. I don't quite get it. I don't own an RTX 5050, right? But I kind of wanted one just to complete the set. And on Prime Day, you could buy one for £214. So I bought one for £214. But you could get an 8 gigabyte 5060 Ti for £270, which is proportionately much better value and not a bad deal, despite the fact it only has 8 gigs of RAM. You could get an RTX 5070 for like £480, which is below MSRP, launch MSRP, which is kind of like mind-blowing almost. So, you know, there do seem to be deals out there, the extent to which this is just sort of like management of existing stock, possibly, where they're able to do this. I don't know how that's all working out, but, you know, it's kind of weird that in the PC space, it is still possible for those components with memory that you would expect to be impacted by all of this to actually be doing quote unquote okay. I mean, it seems to, I mean, even decent deals on the RX 9070 XT with 16 gigs of memory, which is kind of like mind bending. So, you know, I did ask NVIDIA, you know, how are you able to do this? I haven't had a response yet, but it's, you know, the proof is in the pudding, it's out there. Yeah, really, really interesting stuff. Anyway, I guess we should move on from that and crack on with our next news topic. Right then, a very good story this week. We could do some good news. FSR 4.1 had a surprise. Well, I guess it was kind of announced that it was coming, but a surprise drop of a new Adrenaline driver for AMD RX 7000 cards that enables them to run FSR 4.1. Now, obviously, this is really, really important, right? Because something that the prior generation AMD cards have not had is a really decent upscaling solution. And, you know, the machine learning-based techniques seem to produce the best results. FSR 4, generally very, very good. We do now have 4.1 for Radeon RX 7000, but the DLL can basically be used on other architectures as well. The question is whether it's actually going to be effective or not. Anyway, I decided to take a very, very quick look at it. Let's talk about the Radeon RX 7900 XTX, which was the flagship product for RDNA 3. And I decided just to do a couple of very, very quick benchmarks on it. So let me bring up the numbers there. And yeah, let's talk first of all about Cyberpunk 2077, the benchmark game basically of the generation. And we're using 4K resolution here, native 4K, and we're using Psycho RT settings. So it's pretty much as high up as you can go before you're kicking past facing. And it's fair to say that the 7900 XTX just can't really run it. 19.5 frames per second after. Here with like awful frame times, you should be able to see that there, assuming you're watching the video version of the direct. FSR 3 quality mode, that takes things up to a more respectable 38.4 FPS, which is like an extra 97% of performance there, but basically it becomes actually quite pleasant to watch at that point, unlike native. Now, FSR 4 quality mode, 35.4 FPS there, which is basically, you know, very, very similar to FSR 3. You're losing 8% of performance there, but the quality is much, much better. FSR 4 performance mode there, 52.19 FPS. That's an extra 168% of performance there over the native readout there. What's great about this is that basically FSR 4 performance mode looks better than FSR 3 quality mode. Just because of the nature of the upscaling, the quality there is that much better. So, you know, basically performance mode is considerably faster, you know, 52.2 FPS versus 38.4. It's just a win across the board there. Looks better, runs smoother. I mean, you can't get better than that. I also, not rendered here, took a look at FSR 4 Ultra Performance, which is 720p to 4K here. Basically, that's four times faster than native, 77.8 FPS average there. Pretty much the only way to get like 60 FPS locked, if that is still a thing in the PC space in the VRR era. But ultimately, you know, as a first impression of FSR 4, excellent. This is exactly what we wanted. Really, really happy AMD has done this. I was actually revisiting Jack Huynh's presentation for this, for FSR 4. And yeah, I mean, basically it's faster than the leaked DLL. that came out just over a year ago. Faster than that, the quality level is much more on par now with full FSR4 running on RDNA4. This is just absolutely fantastic, I think. I also did some numbers with Resident Evil Requiem, which is a much easier game for the 7900 XTX to handle at maximum settings. And it is maximum, including maximum RT. 36 FPS average there in the cutscene that I've chosen here. FSR3 quality mode, extra 80% of performance there. It's about 64.8 FPS average. But FSR4 quality mode, 57.9 FPS, you're losing 11% versus FSR3 quality mode. But, you know, obviously you can drop down to performance mode, which still looks better, 78.8 FPS. That's basically like 120% of extra performance over native. So this is all really, really cool. It's very, very much best case scenario stuff when you're dealing with the best AMD GPU of that particular generation. Jack Hewin showed some pretty impressive embellishments on the RX 7600, which is, until the Steam Machine came along, it was, pretty much the entry-level card for RDNA 3 there. I'm doing a video on Steam Machine running FSR4 at the moment. In the Q&A show, I showed these clips of Cyberpunk 2077, PS5 performance mode settings, and 1620p output with dynamic resolution scaling from like 50% up to 100% looks great. So, you know, I think this is great across the board for RDNA 4, even, you know, with the Steam Machine, which, I mean, the gains are going to be more limited on lower-end GPUs. But the point is that you can run the Steam Machine at 1440p resolution in FSR4 performance mode, 720p internal resolution, and, you know, it still looks good at 1440p, I think, is the main takeaway there. You're still getting pretty good frame rate boosts over native. Oliver, I'm going to go to you first on this because we've kind of been waiting for this for a long time. I'm not sure the wait was, you know, I'd have liked to have seen it a lot sooner, but it's good to see that AMD did actually produce something that is better suited to the architecture. The RX 7600 comparisons there were quite interesting because they were actually comparing. This is the great thing. I've got to commend them for this. They were comparing the new version of FSR4 against the leaked DLL, and not just the leaked DLL, but the community enhanced version. And basically improved image quality there. Plus, you were getting like a 7% performance advantage there, like for like. Really interesting stuff, right?
That's definitely to their credit. Oh, I would have loved a bespoke, tailored version of that leaked DLL, perhaps to have been released a little bit earlier, because the leaked DLL was released quite a long time ago. And that did seem to exhibit pretty good characteristics. I mean, obviously, this is better, but certainly some improvement, some amelioration of the situation would have been useful earlier. And I think it would also have benefited AMD if they had just been a little bit clearer and maybe had better plans for this from the start. Yeah. Because it seemed like after they shipped FSR4, they didn't really have clear messaging on what they were going to do with their older generation products. If it would arrive on RDNA 3, if it would arrive on RDNA 2, even now they're being cagey on whether it's coming to handhelds or not. Seemingly they've kind of indicated maybe yes, maybe no, maybe there aren't plans at the moment, maybe we'll change our minds. Like, it's kind of all over the place. And I think that kind of inconsistent messaging and unclear messaging doesn't benefit their user base at a time, especially when, and I know I've said this a million times, but like, you know, NVIDIA is shipping DLSS 4.5 on such old graphics hardware, and perhaps it's not ideally suited to that graphics hardware, but, you know, they do ship it on just about anything, at least the image upscaling component of DLSS 4.5. And it's really unfortunate to not see a similar kind of commitment from AMD with respect to their older graphics architectures, right? But I think this is a great addition. This is a great solution. In particular for Steam Machine, it does address some of the limitations of that architecture. It doesn't help you a lot with CPU constraints, especially with the single channel DDR5. It doesn't help you a lot with the RAM constraints, the VRAM constraints, but it does help ease up image quality in these kind of console caliber titles that might not look so great in the consoles, might not look so great in the Steam Machine, But if you do pile on FSR4, they should run and look perfectly acceptably in many cases, because that much enhanced upscaling treatment, and at least in the footage that I have here from Cyberpunk, it does look quite reasonable on Steam Machine, despite running at pretty low internal resolutions in Cyberpunk, which is quite a demanding title from an image quality perspective, I would have to say, with its long lines of sight and whatnot. So yeah, I think this is a very positive sign, but I'd love to see more consistent development effort and more consistent messaging from AMD in the future, because I still think they're kind of leaving a lot of users in the lurch at the moment with their lack of support for handhelds.
Yeah, I agree with you, Oliver, that disclosure on this has been kind of like, you know, the key point of communication is basically to anticipate the questions the audience is going to have and then come up preemptively with the answers so everybody is in the clear. But there's been a lot of, issues on that, and we're still not entirely clear about what's happening with RDNA 3.5 handhelds. I think the latest situation is that they're going to be producing a lightweight model for those processors, which kind of makes sense. I mean, it worked great for Switch 2, could work equally well for RDNA 3.5. But then again, you know, RDNA 3.5 also has Strix Halo, which doesn't need a lightweight model, I don't think. I guess I should give that a test. But yeah, things certainly should be improved there. But ultimately, Tom, I mean, it's good news, right?
Yeah, it is. More tools in the box for especially Steam Machine users to figure out whether they want to trade against, say, you know, going to from FSR3 quality mode, say, if they used that before, go to FSR4 performance mode now. You're still getting a great image, and the performance you're getting back from that could be spent on other settings. So I think it's a win-win for flexibility. No one's being forced to use any settings. So yeah, win-win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we're going to be doing more on this. I want to go in a bit deeper on what's happening on Steam Machine there. I think it is a really interesting, as you say, Tom, a tool in the box there, because specifically for Steam Machine, you have got very limited GPU resources. So the ability to go low on resolution and still get a decent image at 1440p, I think that's actually really, really cool. And it's also something that the PlayStation 5 can't do. Because it just doesn't have the required machine learning capabilities. Obviously, that's not a problem for the PlayStation 5 professional. But yeah, I'm welcoming this, and I think it's really, really nice to actually get it in our hands, not have to worry about using OptiScaler. But with that said, you do still need OptiScaler to work on games like Alan Wake 2 and 007 First Light, basically anything that doesn't use the FSR3 dynamic library there. You do have to resort to OptiScaler, but you can, that's the point. And I guess the OptiScaler thing also means that RDNA 3.5 does allow you to use this model, even if the trades in performance are onerous. But yeah, that's really good news. So well done, AMD. Okay, let's move on again. So alongside the release of the Steam Machine, Valve basically unveiled a new version of SteamOS that is said to support basically any PC that you put together that's using an AMD graphics card, which is welcome news. Now, Oliver, this news was obviously cool, but from my perspective, it was somewhat confusing because I thought they already did that.
Me too. Yeah, actually.
Yeah. So I think the changes here, and I might be a little bit behind in this one, but my best understanding of it is that you absolutely could run SteamOS previously on computers with AMD graphics hardware just fine for the most part. I've seen many people do it, but it wasn't that well supported. There were some headaches. It wasn't as good as running SteamOS on a Steam Deck or on a Legion Go or something that is officially supported. And it wasn't as good as running Bazite on those computers either. Bazite was better supported, generally speaking. That might still be the case. I don't know. Maybe someone should test that out and compare the two experiences now that there is official support. But I think they have made some changes. They've improved support for some of the newer UEFI BIOSes, to my understanding. They've also updated the driver stack considerably. They've added better support for VR, better support for all kinds of different features. I think SteamOS 3.8 is a significant enough upgrade and improves compatibility enough that Valve is kind of sticking a stake in the sand and saying, we're done. not we're done with development, but you can use it. You can use it on your own personal computer if you have appropriate hardware. That is the distinction here. But there are still some issues with this process. Like, to my understanding, SteamOS installed through the usual channels is not really that great in dual booting situations. I don't really think it works on a, you know, drive partition basis. You really want to have a separate drive for SteamOS, or just use your computer exclusively for SteamOS. So if you do want a dual booting experience, perhaps Bazite is a better option here on a single drive with a partition. And also, of course, the primary focus here is on AMD desktop systems because of the much, much better maturity of AMD's Linux drivers than NVIDIA's or Intel's, any other graphics vendor in this space. Right. And ultimately, I do think that for handheld systems as well, given all the various optimizations and all the various compatibility tweaks that go into making a handheld work as a SteamOS, as a Linux device, I do think you want to go Bazite in that case, because the Bazite devs have a great affinity for handhelds, and they are working very hard to ensure the best compatibility possible on these handheld AMD systems in particular. But yeah, this is welcoming news. Good to see it. I'd be very curious to see some testing on this, though, to see how good the experience actually is, especially relative to Bazite or the other ways to get Linux running on a home desktop PC with a SteamOS-like interface.
Yeah, Oliver, my sort of reaction to this was kind of like almost a sort of, okay, that's nice, but a bit of a shrug of the shoulders, because obviously when I was doing my testing for the Steam machine, I was using Bazite for the other GPUs, and it is functionally the same as SteamOS, really, isn't it? All of the cool things that SteamOS does is also in Bazite, and there is support for basically it's almost like everything Valve wants to do. You know, they've got support for NVIDIA in there if you want that. Obviously, you know, the benchmarks I think are valid because it is basically using the same RadV driver as SteamOS. So, you know, everything sort of aligns there already. But I guess the concept that Valve actually has, you know, a distro you can use that they're saying will run on anything is actually a bit of a milestone. And I think it sort of ties into a question here from supporter, what can I say, exclamation point. Somewhat warm welcome to you all. Somewhat. Do you think the Steam Machine is intended to be a major commercial success in its own right, or is Valve primarily using it to accelerate the adoption of SteamOS and reduce gaming's reliance on Windows across the wider PC market? Curious about your thoughts about that, Tom, because I actually think that Steam Machine is kind of like a spearhead product, if you like, to basically say, hey, you know, actually... you don't need to worry about Linux gaming anymore. Steam Machine is pretty good, but you can build your own machine, whatever specs you want, and it's going to be great.
Yeah, I almost saw it as the equivalent to the Steam Deck in that it sort of stood as the benchmark for a handheld optimization. So if developers wanted to target a spec, that would be kind of like the baseline, and we've seen like other manufacturers build on that. I think the plan might have moved on a little bit, since it really depends on the adoption of Steam Machine, like how, with the parts crisis going on right now, I don't know how widely it'll be adopted, and therefore whether developers will optimize it specifically to Steam Machine as they might have before. But I agree, yeah, it is kind of meant to be that starting point to get the ball rolling, to get people invested in that ecosystem. And yeah, it's maybe not, it's at its best ebb right now with the pricing, but I think it's a forward investment for sure.
I think it's really interesting because you could almost define Steam Machine as like a stake in the ground. You know, it's not a particularly powerful PC, but you know, if your game runs on it, then it's going to be running quite well on a lot of mainstream gaming PCs out there.
So exactly.
If there is the concept of a kind of reference specification for desktop gaming, this is actually a pretty good place to be. And it does tie in sort of performance-wise with what's happening at the top of the Steam hardware surface. So I think that's really cool. I think the other thing which I think I talked about this in the Q&A show is that fundamentally Windows is is not a great experience for gaming at the moment. Certainly not for a set-top box for the living room, that kind of thing. SteamOS just works, and it works great. You know, all of the things that I don't particularly like about Windows just don't happen on SteamOS. You know, that's the bottom line. I guess the foremost among them would be like shader compilation. All of that stuff is taken care of you on SteamOS in a way that Windows is still sort of struggling to catch up with. The fact that the interface is smooth, fast, doesn't lag. I mean, it's a world apart from my experiences using the Xbox mode on PC. Things just work. Things feel lean, optimized. And I think that's pretty cool. The issues that SteamOS does have are also things that Valve are looking to address, principally the fact that, well, let's face facts, most of the market have got NVIDIA GPUs. You kind of need to have proper NVIDIA support in SteamOS for this to really move on to the next level. And they're doing that. They're looking into that. They're apparently collaborating with NVIDIA. I think that's great, great news. So, yeah, I am seeing that maybe this new SteamOS launch is a milestone of sorts, but it's still basically a stake in the ground, and hopefully much, much better things are coming. And the point where I can safely use SteamOS or with an NVIDIA GPU and access all of those high-end NVIDIA features, I think is definitely something that Microsoft should be worried about. So our final news story of the week, Sonic Frontiers is now available for Nintendo Switch 2. Lots of interest in this one, Tom. You decided to take a look at it for us. Tell us more.
Yeah, right. Do you want me to just barrage you with information about what it's about?
Why not?
Yeah, I had about exactly, well, one day with it to get a measure of what it's doing compared to Switch 1 especially. But the basics first are it's £45, which is, you know, actually all right for a Switch 2 title, but the fact is you can't upgrade from the original Switch 1 release, which is a bit of a mean move by Sega, and they really should have offered that as an upgrade path for a cheaper cost, especially since you can actually transfer your saves across. There's actually a feature within the Switch 2 Definitive Edition to actually get your saves and make them work. But on the plus side, it is definitive. The definitive edition version includes all the DLC to date. You get, the Horizon story campaign, extra items, digital art book, soundtrack. These are all lovely things. So as a value proposition, I'd say it's kind of like, if you've not played the original Switch 1 version, it's worth that. But if not, it's a bit of a bit frustrating, I'd say. Now, for a kind of recap, Switch 1, where John covered this one, the Switch 1 version of Sonic Frontiers was not a looker. It was basically the game running in potato mode. Every setting, every single dial on the you could imagine was dropped to low. You were missing ripple physics. You were missing the GI. Even motion blur was switched off, disabled entirely, despite the fact there was actually a toggle in the game to enable it, which was quite bizarre. Notably, a level of detail settings were atrocious. Like, you'd just be walking within like a meter ahead of you, you'd see like grass just popping right in front of you. And it's just an image quality obviously suffered from being 576p to 720p or thereabouts dynamic in the docked play on Switch 1. So so it can only get better is what I'm saying. And they have addressed a lot of those points, but it's still not entirely a good looking package. It is, of course, a game of two halves. So you've got the cyber world missions, which are like the traditional Sonic levels, or 3D style, 2D style, side scrolling. And then there's the open world stuff. And the open world stuff is where it usually suffers more. The traditional style is a lot better and presents better, even on Switch 1, I'd say. Switch 2 rectifies this by adding two options. You get a 60fps performance mode, which is enabled by default, and a graphics mode at 30, and most cutscenes remain at 30 regardless. So the difference between the two really is that quality mode, the graphics mode, is 1080p typically. The performance mode is 720p typically. And when you go to the portable mode, you're looking at a dynamic setup of 480p to 720p while in performance mode, and while portable in the graphics mode, it's 720p to 1080p. So expect a lot of muddiness. In other words, it's a lot of very blurry image quality, not helped by the fact the anti-aliasing method isn't the greatest, I'd say. Yes, so besides that, the modes are divided by resolution targets, 1080p versus 720p, but you also get SSR, screen space reflections, on the graphics mode as the bonus, which bizarrely is on the Switch 1 version by default. So by going for 60 FPS on the Switch 2, you're losing a feature that was originally on the Switch 1 version. So no screen space reflections in these open world segments, at least. But otherwise, the two modes are identical. Like, level of detail settings, grass, foliage, shadows, textures, everything is absolutely identical. So it really comes down to, in terms of Switch 2 improvements, an image quality boost and also settings. So I did a few comparisons I've sent to you, Oliver. There's everything is pretty much touched on, like textures, shadows, improved LODs, crucially, for grass and trees and geometry. And even when you're stood on the spot in the same place around you, it'll be higher density detailing overall. So all round, it's like, yeah, they have bumped up it a setting for every parameter possible. And then there's also cutscenes, which suffered from some hideous compression in the Switch 1 version. John noted that as well. And they have gone back and re-rendered those, but I'm still looking at them thinking, gosh, they're pretty rough. So, yeah, I'd say overall, it really divides into two halves what you're getting with Switch 2. The traditional Sonic levels look good while you're playing, like the 3D, like, linear sections, but when you go to the open world, you're going to see some really crude pop in still. You're going to see trees flip LOD stages right in front of you from a meter away. We're still missing the motion blur of the PS5 release. We're still missing settings like the ripple physics on water, and I believe GI is missing as well, though. I need to look into that a bit further. Yeah, so it's a lot of those deluxe settings I wasn't exactly expecting in the Switch 2 package, but to see the level of detail stuff is still an issue, though improved, is still an issue, is a bit of a shame. So yes, which leads to performance. There's the 30 FPS mode, which, just like the Switch 1 version, is 30 with uneven frame pacing. Which sounds wonderful for a Sonic game, obviously. It's just a stuttery experience. And I, you know, if you were to go back to the Mega Drive game, Mega Drive days, and handed people this, they would have been very disappointed to see this is their future. But then you do have the 60 FPS mode, which is enabled by default. And if you can stomach the lack of SSR, the drop in image quality to 720p while docked, a more variable 480p to 720p while portable, is pretty really solid. Like, especially the Cyberworld stages, you know, this is the biggest win for the Switch 2 version. You're getting 60 right away with some cut to image quality there. The only caveat being that in portable mode, I noticed there were some drops just generally exploring the open world segments. But if your main focus is just like the enjoying the traditional levels, then I don't think it's going to be much of an issue. So yeah, it is a win. £45 though, and no upgrade path. It's if you've not experienced it before, it's maybe worth a go. And if you want to have it in handheld form, it's worth a shot. But I can't help but feel you're better served by the PS5 version or something, you know, a level up from that. I really thought they'd get more out of the Hedgehog Engine 2 on Switch 2 hardware, but it just seems like maybe at a basic level it's more CPU bound than most people expected, and exploring those open levels was more of a CPU hog, so they had to keep a lot of the settings in check. But I don't know if you've had any time to play Sonic Frontiers in any iteration, guys, or see the
no, it's not really been on my radar. Any thoughts there, Oliver?
No, Tom, I've had time to look at your footage, though. Okay. I've had time to look at various pieces of footage I've seen online, and I gotta say, I'm not too impressed with the state of the game. The quality mode, the graphics mode, unstable 30 FPS with that frame pacing issue, does not sound too promising, and image quality there isn't that great. Besides, kind of looks ugly too. Not the biggest fan of that. Performance mode is where I would settle with a TED like this. Normally a pretty high speed 3D platformer, but the image quality is atrocious. I gotta say, it's pretty bad. It's really not very good. In general, Sonic Frontiers doesn't look good most of the time, even on the highest end systems out there, but certainly on Switch 2, not too appetizing. In general, I think Sega has not done a great job with their Switch 2 ports. Like, we saw Sonic X Shadow Generations, which I think was 30 FPS. We saw Raidu Remastered, which was kind of primitive, I would say, on Switch 2. We saw Persona 3 Reload, which had its own issues on Switch 2 that were kind of rectified. Not in an amazing place, but better. And then we saw the Yakuza titles on Switch 2. I did take a look at one of them, and it was kind of mediocre. It was like a PS3 era. I think it was Yakuza Kiwami. A PS3 era title that was like not that exciting relative to its outcomes on a system like the Steam Deck. So not the biggest fan. And also Sonic Racing Cross Worlds, which did run okay, had some minor performance issues. Not my favorite title visually, but definitely stripped back relative to PS4 and Xbox One in terms of their visual outcomes in that title, with no screen space reflections, none of the kind of higher-end rendering features that typified that title's look on platforms outside the Switch 1 and Switch 2. So I feel like Sega's not done the best job with their titles over time, and maybe some of that speaks to just like, you know, engine issues, like with the Hedgehog engine,
right,
whatnot. Maybe that's not ideally situated for a game like this, but I think they should step up their overall technical quality with their Switch 2 software.
Agreed.
Because so far, definitely some room for improvement, and I think we're seeing that with this title.
Yeah.
Right, okay. There's something that really annoys me about this is it's the fact that there is no upgrade path for Switch 1 for what is essentially, well, it is the same game, right? But they do offer you the ability to save, transfer your save from Switch 1 to Switch 2, which, you know, it seems kind of like illogical with the fact that it's not compatible with the notion that you can't upgrade the existing game. You've got to buy the game again from scratch, and then you can access your old save. It's just kind of like not great, is it? Yeah. It's not consumer friendly, to say the least. Makes you wonder why they went down that approach. It's not good at all. Any final words on this one? Would you recommend it?
Well,
Tom, I mean, do you think that there are actual, I mean, what would you have expected from a Switch 2 version of this game?
Well, To be honest, looking at the results of the other versions, you know, and how those scale to like PS5, there are some obvious issues with LODs on those versions. Pop-in is still a big issue. I think it's just an engine level problem in a lot of ways, and they were trying to navigate that with the hardware they had. So it's I was expecting, well, I suppose 60 FPS is just the biggest win here. Like, that solves the 30 FPS frame pacing problem. But in terms of the quality mode, I was actually expecting a lot more. You know, I was expecting it to be flourishing with a lot of different settings that we're seeing on the other versions, but just aren't there. This is the first time I've ever played it, by the way, and I hadn't, because John covered it, I was like, okay, well, I hadn't had a chance at the time to really check it out. Having a good time. I think it's very playable, and if you're a first-time player looking for a handheld version, it's not ideal. You're going to see some ugly spots for sure. It's really rough. But once you get into those Cyberworld stages, it's great. It's good fun.
All right. Well, we're going to do that show on a bit of a downer then. But that was the last news story. Please do like, subscribe, share if you enjoyed what we've done this week. Ring bells for notifications, that sort of thing. DF supporter program, patreon.com/digitalfoundry. If you enjoy Digital Foundry content, want early access to a bunch of stuff, updates on the team, access to our excellent community on Discord, please do consider that. But that's all from us on this one. Thanks for watching and supporting Digital Foundry. And perhaps inevitably, we'll see you next week.